Welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast, the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. We seek to strengthen public confidence in Canadian energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. I'm your host, Brendan Frank. Over the last 40 years, proposals for liquefied natural gas projects, or LNG, have appeared around the globe to mixed success. Some never obtain adequate funding or permits, and others proceed to a final investment decision and then commissioning. In Canada, there are very few academic or public policy studies on LNG investment and which factors influence final investment decisions. There are even fewer studies on final investment decisions for alternative energy projects such as solar and hydrogen. Our guest today is Positive Energy research affiliate Andrew Pickford. Among his many, many titles, Andrew is a senior fellow at the Montreal Economic Institute, a fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographic Society, and a senior fellow at the University of Alberta's China Institute. He served as executive director of the Mankel Economic Education Foundation for 4 years and is currently putting the finishing touches on his PhD at the University of Western Australia. His new paper for Positive Energy is titled Unbuilt and Built LNG Projects: Who Decides and How? Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you.
So let's start by defining a few terms. What is a final investment decision and what is so special about it?
Brendan, that's a term which is used a lot in the oil and gas sector to refer to when a major investment is going to occur. It tends to take years to progress to what they call a FID or final investment decision. And it really means that the board of the company or the joint venture signs off and allocates the money for the project to start. So in the energy sector, it's a major milestone, which essentially means a project will proceed or it won't proceed and it will go back to the drawing board.
And you say the energy sector, but maybe we can split that out a bit. So in terms of final investment decisions for oil and gas projects versus renewable projects, are there key differentiators when it comes to final investment decisions?
I think in energy broadly, and you're seeing the larger and larger renewable hydrogen and other proposals come up, from an investor and board decision, it's really the quantum which is the big issue. So I don't see huge differences sector by sector. But with any energy investment, it's really a milestone which gives you the approval to proceed. Now, typically in LNG, which is the focus of the study that we're discussing, the projects are by their nature very, very large, extremely complex, and involve a lot of infrastructure. So they typically go into the billions of dollars, which means that you have a much more formalized process for a investment approval, or gates, as they call in the sector. Now, renewables and other energy forms are taking that, and they are getting quite big. So they will come up, they will start to look like that, but not yet.
So this paper is about LNG, as you mentioned, and you walk through the history in the study. Without spilling the beans too much, could you take us through that history at a high level?
Thanks, Brennan. And I say this as someone who's doing a PhD in energy history and gas, which is probably the least studied part of the energy sector in terms of its history. And I think it's quite important because when you look at Western Australia and British Columbia, you look at two very similar jurisdictions. And what happened is early in the 80s, as Japan was starting to look to need its next wave of gas deliveries, you had two projects, one in Western Australia and one in British Columbia, competing against each other. And without going into the nitty-gritty and the backroom discussions, it both were quite competitive, but for various reasons, the Western Australian proposal got over the line. And in these big projects, when and they tend to be Asian and traditionally Japanese buyers, although that's changed in the last few decades. Once you've secured that agreement, it really gives you more capacity to move to the next steps. So that history of the initial investment kickstarted the industry in Western Australia, and then it essentially left British Columbia without an LNG sector in the 80s or 90s. And in the paper, I argue that there was a confluence of forces, which meant that when the next investment window opened, which is really means when there was a lot of demand for gas in Asia that warranted new capacity, that Western Australia was very uniquely and well positioned to supply that and attract the investment. And Australia wide, it was about $200 billion. Now, it's not nothing, there's nothing inherently problematic or against British Columbia, but it was just the reason I delve into the history is I argue that there's a first mover advantage. And having lived in Perth during that time, these projects require an ecosystem of skills which develops and it makes it more attractive for subsequent investment. So that 80s, early 80s was a pivotal time and probably not well understood in the industry, aside from some very senior players. That, I argue, is one of the timing differences which had an impact on the development of both WA and BC in terms of its LNG projects.
And beyond the first mover advantage, what other key differences or similarities even did you see between the jurisdictions of Western Australia and British Columbia?
I think on the political legal side, they're very similar and they're both essentially British-based Westminster-style politics with government and opposition, and on the surface are very, very similar. So it's not like we're comparing a civil law and common law system or radically different structures. But one thing that developed in Western Australia was something called a state agreement, and it was essentially an instrument used by the government to attract investment. And typically what that meant is a big project proponent would negotiate with the government over a big industrial park. One was for a refinery or iron ore mine or LNG facility. And it would outline at a very high level the obligations of the company and the obligations of the government. And with this agreement, which was negotiated at the sort of premier level, and the senior executives of the company signed off, it was then ratified by an act of parliament. So what this did is it essentially de-risked the projects. The project proceeds based on a higher level of guarantee than a simple standard agreement. Now, the companies are still bound by all the same regulations. They still have to meet safety and environmental and other codes. But what it does from an investor perspective, it takes away some of the political risk that exists. And they're not always, they have been used in different ways and different shapes. Not all LNG projects have a state agreement. But for the first one had a state agreement, which was fundamental to its success. And other ones in more tricky and larger types had it. Now, again, this is fairly unique to Western Australia as a jurisdiction. British Columbia had a forestry industry and it had some conventional oil and gas, or probably more in Alberta. So the mega projects were not as familiar to British Columbia as they were to Western Australia. And Western Australia had an instrument to essentially channel it through to get the approvals done and also to ratify and reduce political risk. So as the companies review and consider these things, the political risk is sort of a big and a growing factor which they consider. So that it's a fairly subtle difference, and I said it's a legal instrument, but it's one that is worth studying for, not necessarily just for LNG, but it serves as a useful template to de-risk projects if the jurisdiction is interested in attracting foreign capital, which many provinces in Canada and states in Australia seek to do.
And yet, despite the absence of efforts to politically de-risk LNG projects in British Columbia, you note in the paper that some Canadian actors perceived a positive final investment decision as inevitable, count tax revenue and allocate it prior to any confirmed investments, and basically take the project's approval as a given. Can you talk about that a bit?
It's interesting. I actually lived in Canada at that stage and was involved in some briefings in Ottawa, Toronto and Vancouver. One thing I noticed was that because your conventional oil and gas sector is quite different in terms of size and scope, oil sands exempt, and especially in British Columbia, there was almost a view once you had a number with a billion and a date that it was almost a guarantee that it would proceed. And of course, there's you need to build a bit of momentum from a company perspective, and they will use these for their own purposes and also engaging with the host government. But it was striking to see that the there was almost an argument over dividing the pie before there was agreement that you put the pie in the oven. And I kept urging caution to say a lot of these projects will not necessarily proceed, but as soon as you start to change the rules mid-course, that really weighs heavily on the decision-making of the IOCs, because they see it as a jurisdiction which will rapidly change its rules. And in any of these projects, I don't want to think that they're that anywhere host governments say come and do what you want, because a lot of governments put on restrictions. Western Australia puts on a restriction to force domestic gas to be sold into the local market. So it's not without cost. But one thing that is constant is that the need and view that you should have a predictable regulatory and investment framework. And I think those calls to tax LNG and to essentially count it in the revenue side of the provincial budget, I did make a few comments, and even within some industry figures, they sort of were more bullish than I was, because even in WA and other places which have a lot of these very good prospective projects, an FID date does not really mean anything. It just means a decision point, and more often than not, it will be abandoned and pushed back. So I think there was a bit of a disconnect with the political and bureaucracy within Vancouver in that establishment. And again, WA, simply because it had experienced it, was probably in a better position because it knew what it meant, and they didn't change the rules of the game midway.
So between the conception of this study and its release, a lot has changed for the LNG sector. We have new reports from the IPCC, the International Energy Agency, and others, all basically talking about the risk, growing risk of investing in LNG. So how do you square the learnings from your paper with what is a rapidly changing investment environment?
That's a good question, Brendan. And I know we've been liaising on this with your positive energy team. I'll explain why it's relevant, and then I'll give some context to the changing market dynamics. So the process to attract these big LNG investments, and essentially the template that I've provided as a case study, it really can be applied to any major energy project. And that doesn't necessarily have to be LNG. It doesn't even have to be fossil fuels. It could be a mix of a green hydrogen project or more of a mixed offering involving renewable energy, and that has a large offtake and presumably will go to load centres in Asia where there is a heavy demand, or potentially domestically. So while we may not proceed in the next few decades with the LNG pipeline that we did in the 2010s, and they certainly will look a lot different, the deep study of a mechanism to get to FID for a big energy project applies across the board. And I think, having read a lot of policies of various countries on their ambitions in hydrogen and clean energy, I think this would be a useful instrument for really any subnational government to consider if they do want to play in that space. There's quite a lot of capital that is now filtered through ESG lens. And as Canada is a very historically low political risk and a developed country, it would be very attractive to park those funds. So there's a case for looking forward to use it. Now, and we're recording this in early October 2021, the energy markets are in convulsions at the moment. And that is, again, that is partly related to some of the financing, but partly related to some very unusual forces, which are seeing spot cargoes of LNG landing in Asia at some very high prices and high benchmarks of Newcastle coal, thermal coal, coming out of Eastern Australia. So, yes, there is a shift, but it's going to be incredibly choppy. And one thing that we might see that I haven't foreshadowed a lot in the report, but has emerged since I began it, was a different type of LNG project which will be sanctioned that may involve methanation process, decarbonisation, reducing the gas burn of it, and also then blending with hydrogen. So the short-term noise of the energy market, and energy markets are always boom and bust, is something to put aside. But I do see that in that bridging period, you may see in some of the scenarios an uptick as you shift out of coal, and LNG is that still that transition fuel. But it will look a lot different, and it will be much patchier than anyone expected, say, 6-12 months ago, because the space has moved in terms of the capital allocation targets leading into Glasgow, but also in how the industry approaches its new projects. So I think a few trends, again, just to build on that, you'll see a lot more shift to smaller scale LNG, and I think you'll see some more modular offerings. And I think we may never return again to these mega projects, Chevron's Gorgon in Western Australia or LNG Canada, which are significant major projects. I think it will be more incremental. It might not look and be the same, but there will still be projects of a scale. And again, they will be, it's more dynamic than I've seen at any time in the LNG sector in the past 20 years. Again, this podcast would sound very different in a month's time.
So looking to future mega projects outside of the LNG sector, beyond COP26 at Glasgow, the push for industrialized nations to ramp up their nationally determined contributions, are there any other learnings that our listeners can or should take from your study?
The one thing that comes across in especially the Western Australian case that may be relevant for, partially relevant for British Columbia, is the role that industrializing Asia will play in terms of if Japan and South Korea move to a hydrogen sector, that there will be a real consideration, and there's a lot of discussion on now, what does a hydrogen contract and offtake agreement look like? What is the pricing mechanisms? What is the delivery structure? And what are some of the technologies involved? So while, again, delving into the history, the LNG sector has overcome huge technological and geographical challenges, and it successfully deployed solutions to create moving gas molecules in liquid form from production centres to demand centres, traditionally in the Indo-Pacific. So I think that if you're interested in looking at the practical aspects of the next steps of the energy transition and investment patterns, I think this is a very good introduction to some of the concepts, and it hopefully will bridge the academic research closer to the investment community, and also linking in with some of the internal discussions within the companies, because the majors and super majors, they are grappling with this on a daily basis, and they're working out how quickly to pivot. So I think this adds a little bit to sort of bringing it all together in an investment perspective. And again, it may be that this template is very useful for the state agreement model is very useful for attracting mega hydrogen projects in any jurisdiction. So if it can contribute to that, that would be a useful addition to the debate.
Seems like a good note to leave things on. Andrew Pickford, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. To see more of our research and to find out about upcoming events, check out our website. Today's episode was recorded on the traditional and unceded territory of the Algonquin people. It was produced by Alicia Aziz, Raphael Desordi, and myself, Brendan Frank. We'll be back next month. See you soon.